Good morning to you. This is day two of our storytelling. We're starting off in Missouri. We're going to go to the Oregon Trail. We're starting off at Independence. Why don't we start off this morning at the little town of Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N. It's right on the river. And there's a man there that owns a store. His name is Peter Hardiman Burnett. The man does a little preaching for the Church of Christ, and he runs his store. But he's up on his soapbox today out in front of his store, and he's trying to talk us into going to Oregon. This is late 1842, and he says he's going to take off in April, next spring, 1843. In fact, why don't you pretend you're a little 14-year-old teenager named Edward Lennox. Lennox kept a diary. I'm not making this up. Lennox says that one day his father came home and said, "I'm going to go over here to Weston and hear this man talk. He's talking about Oregon." And Eddie said, "Daddy, let me go with you. Can I go with you?" And he said, "Come on." And this is what Eddie writes. "One Saturday morning, Father said he was going to hear Mr. Burnett talk about Oregon. I said, 'Father, I want to go too.' He replied, 'All right, son, come on.' And together we went. When the hour for the address came, Mr. Burnett hauled a box out onto the sidewalk, took his stand upon it, and began to tell us about the land flowing with milk and honey on the shores of the Pacific. Burnett's never been there. What's he know about the land flowing with milk and honey? But he's a preacher. He's got imagination. He's never been to heaven either. But he's probably spun some stories about heaven. So here he is standing on his box, telling people about the land flowing with milk and honey, which he knows nothing about. But he doesn't want to go alone. He wants you and me to go with him, form a train, the land flowing with milk and honey on the shores of the Pacific. Of his address that day, I remember this much, that he told us about the great crops of wheat which it was possible to raise in Oregon. And he pictured in glowing terms the richness of the soil and the attractiveness of the climate. And then, with a little twinkle of humor in his eye, he said, 'And they do say, gentlemen, they do say that out in Oregon, the pigs are running about under the great acorn trees, round and fat and already cooked, with knives and forks sticking in them, so you can cut off a slice whenever you are hungry.' Of course, at this, everybody laughed. But they did more than laugh. They signed up. Almost 900. 800 and some people following Peter Hardiman Burnett all the way to Oregon. And included in that group were the Hembree families that I talked about yesterday. Three separate Hembree families. H-E-M-B-R-E-E, all members of the Church of Christ, as was Burnett. From McMinnville, Tennessee. They had made their way to western Missouri, ready to go to Oregon, and off they went. So I pick up with the trivia question I left you with yesterday. Who was the first person to ever die on the Oregon Trail? And it was a little six-year-old boy from a family in the Church of Christ, little Joel Hembree, playing on the tongue of his daddy's wagon. And the family didn't think it was dangerous. As the wagon bounced along that road, rough, hard road, bouncing and bouncing, and the boy fell off the tongue of the wagon, and the iron-rimmed wheels rolled over his body, not just the front wheels, but the back wheels as well, because the oxen don't know any better. They just keep pulling. And before anybody knew what was happening, the boy was lying there in the road. His father, Joel, knelt over him. His mother, Sally, was 9 months pregnant. It's amazing the boy didn't die immediately. He lived through the night. And he died at 2 o'clock the next afternoon. The accident happened on Tuesday, July 18. He died on July 19. 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They dug a grave 4.5 feet deep. I can prove that. They didn't have a coffin. They took a drawer out of the chest of drawers, put it over his body, filled it up with rocks, and Brother Newby was traveling with them, William and Sarah Newby, and William took a flat stone, and he carved into it, J. Hembree, 1843. But Brother Newby wasn't well educated, and he got his four backward. Sort of looks like Little Abner in Dogpatch, got that backward four. And he put that over the grave, and they wrote a sign that they attached to the rock that told about this little boy dying. They knew they could never come back to clean that grave. They were 1,000 miles from home and 1,000 miles from the promised land. The accident took place about 14 miles west of what we call today Douglas, Wyoming. There at Squaw Creek. I have found 5 different diaries of people who went by that year and wrote about it in their diary that a little boy died at that spot. But within a year, the grave was obliterated and lost to history for 118 years. And then in 1961, a man was clearing his land outside Douglas, Wyoming, and he stumbled onto that rock and he cleaned it off and he saw that it said J. Hembree, 1843, and he surmised that it was an immigrant grave. And he got a hold of OCTA, Oregon and California Trail Association. I'm a member of OCTA. He got a hold of OCTA, and they confirmed, yes, a little boy did die at that spot in 1843. And on an appointed day in 1961, 200 people came together, and they dug down and found that grave. And in my book, I run a picture of the skeleton that they uncovered that day. And they lovingly took those bones and reburied them in a beautiful coffin. They were able to determine how he died, fractured skull. And they took those bones, put them in a coffin, moved it up to higher ground, about 1,000 feet up, put a fence all the way around it. Even though it's on private property, you can go and see it today. It's not far off Interstate 80. When I wrote my book, I called the family who owns the ranch, Butch and Jody White. And I said, could I put in a footnote that people could go and see this grave? Because I'm running a picture of the grave and the skeleton and the stone. It's all in my book. And they said, well, that'll be fine, but put in your book that we would like for people to come up and knock on our door rather than wander around our property. Just put that you'd like them to come and knock on the door, and we'll show them where the grave is. That'd be all right. I said, well, it won't be many. I don't think you'll be bothered much, but I'd appreciate if you'd let me put it in there. Well, I called them recently, and Butch said, how many copies of that book have you sold? Everybody going down Interstate 80 stops to see that grave. They've had a lot of company. And that's a pretty meaningful grave, the first person to ever die on the Oregon Trail, a little boy from the Church of Christ. Do you know that 7 days later, Sally gave birth to a daughter? I call this section of the book, Life and Death on the Oregon Trail. Can you imagine burying one child and bringing another one in the space of 7 days on the Oregon Trail, knowing that they would never be able to come back and see that grave again? In 1846, the McBrides came to Oregon. I talked a lot about the McBrides yesterday. And one of the teenage boys in the family was keeping a diary, John Rogers McBride. He was 14 years old, and the diary's at the Oregon History Center. And it's marvelous. It's over 100 pages. It's a wonderful book. And he's full of stories. He tells the story of a storm that came up one night. And by the time the storm was over, his father looked around and realized that two of his ponies was missing and one mule. And he wasn't going to Oregon without those two ponies and that mule. And he took two other guys, and he said, we're going to ride out and find those ponies. The rest of you keep going in the train. We'll catch up to you. And they rode 15 miles without finding those ponies. And at the end of the 15 miles, they came over a little rise and came down into a little hollow and stumbled onto 150 Indians who began to chase them. And they turned and started riding back those 15 miles. All they remembered were the Indians grabbing dirt and slapping it on their forehead, which they didn't think was good news. They slapped it on their forehead and started yelling something and started chasing them. And these three men, led by Dr. James McBride, started riding back for all they were worth, 15 miles. And when the word got to the wagon train, when the last person in the train saw what was happening, and the news spread through the train that McBride was coming with 150 Indians on his tail, this is what John Rogers wrote. He said, "The consternation that prevailed on this announcement can hardly be described. Women shrieked, and children ran in fright to bury themselves in hiding in the wagons, and men, grown men, blanched with fear, and then began to look for their arms to meet the foe. And Glenn Burnett, that great gospel preacher that we talked about yesterday, took command of the movements of the train and ordered it corralled. And they got all the wagons into a circle and they corralled the wagons. And McBride came riding up out of breath, but he made it. And his two companions made it. And everybody grabbed guns and they were going to defend themselves. And John Rogers McBride writes, "I was especially impressed. I was especially impressed with the leadership of my mother. My mother was a brave little woman. I didn't know this. Brave little woman, 36 years old. She had passed through early Indian disturbance in the state of Missouri when she was a child. And now that she realized that my father was safe and was at her side, she was as self-possessed as if she had marched over 100 battlefields. She was excited, but she was not unnerved. And the calm way she went about assisting in the preparations for our defense at once quieted all of our fears. And seeing that the fortified train was ready to fight, the Indians halted their pursuit and refrained from attacking. And within a half hour, the crisis had passed." Dr. James McBride, the man riding there to save his life, became one of the founders of the Republican Party in Oregon, great friend of Abraham Lincoln. When Lincoln won election by a narrow margin in Oregon in 1860, he honored two members of the Church of Christ in Oregon, William Lysander Adams, who I told you about yesterday with Yamhill University. William Lysander Adams was made collector of the port at Astoria by Abraham Lincoln. And McBride, Dr. James McBride, he was made ambassador to the Sandwich Islands, which we know today as the Hawaiian Islands. And he went out to Honolulu in 1863. And there he had dinner most every night with Admiral Enquist of the Russian fleet. And Admiral Enquist said to him, "Why doesn't your country buy Alaska? We don't want it." And so McBride started writing a series of letters. I've seen them. They're in the Library of Congress. He wrote a series of letters to the Secretary of State, William Seward. And he said, "We ought to buy Alaska." And it took him 4 years to persuade him. But Seward finally was persuaded. And our history books call Alaska what? Seward's Folly. But you pick up the four-volume history, that big set called The History of the Great Northwest, and it'll tell you the truth in that book, that the father of the Alaska Purchase is an elder in the Church of Christ named Dr. James McBride, who talked Seward into buying Alaska in 1867. Well, John Rogers McBride said that one night, a woman got sick on their train, Mrs. Cromwell, and her father, his father being a doctor, Dr. James McBride, was summoned over to the wagon in the middle of the night. And he tried his best to save this woman's life, but he couldn't do it. As the first streaks of dawn were coming across the camp, the woman died. And John Rogers wakes up, and this is what he writes in his diary. "My first knowledge of her illness was on waking at daylight and hearing the sounds of weeping in the tent nearby, occupied by the Cromwell family. I shall never forget the grief of that motherless boy. Nothing could comfort him." The boy was 12 years old. "His moans and his sobs were heart-rending. And the wild grief of the young girls." He had two little sisters. "And the more quiet but deep anguish of the husband and father left an impression on me that time cannot efface. She was buried that day on the lonely banks of the turbid river. Death on the plains in those days was a terrible thought. Hundreds of miles in the deep wilderness, nothing but the rushing of the waters and the tread of the buffalo or the savage around the spot. Wolves sneaking over the plains, ready the moment the grave was abandoned to commence the work of digging for the remains. It was the thoughts of these things that made death on the plains so awful in those days. Placed in a neat coffin made from portions of a wagon box and used for that very purpose, in a grave dug by loving hands, the lady was laid to rest forever. And I will never forget Glenn Owen Burnett, gospel preacher, leading the prayer at that grave. I have witnessed many funerals, but never once since in a long life have I witnessed one so solemn, so gloomy, and so terrible as this. The Cromwells, the father, the 12-year-old boy, and the two little girls, traveled with us for another 250 miles. But life in Oregon without their mother had no appeal for them. And when we got to Fort Laramie, they turned around and went back home to Missouri. Wow. Went all the way to Fort Laramie. But the dad had no heart to start life over again in Oregon without his wife. Said to his children, "We're going back home." And turned around and went all the way back. I want to tell you about a woman named Anna Rigdon, who I think I've met in some of my congregations, some of her descendants. Anna was 25 years old in this story, and she is one strong woman. Why she went to Oregon with a husband like Tom, I don't know. Tom was so sick that they knew the day they left he couldn't drive the wagon. In fact, Tom was going to lay down in the back of the wagon for 2,000 miles with two of the children. She was going to sit up in the front wagon with the little baby. He was two. His name was Townsend, baby boy. So they hired a 16-year-old boy, Silas Higgins, to drive this wagon. Silas Higgins had never driven a wagon from here to that wall, and now he's going to drive a wagon to Oregon, 2,000 miles. Well, they started out from Independence. They crossed the Missouri River. That was pretty good right there. They got into Kansas. They're doing pretty good. They got to the North Platte River. It had been raining. The river was swollen. Not easy to get across those swollen rivers. It's not easy to get across those rivers when they're not swollen. And with the waters up high, Silas sort of timidly started out into that river. They got about halfway over, and the water swept under the legs of the oxen. They got disoriented, got turned around, wagon got turned around, and they started down the current and to sure destruction. They were going to die. In the back, Thomas is holding the two little children. He can't help. And they're on their way to destruction. I have found two accounts, and both of the accounts agree that when they began to drift downstream, one account says that Silas, quote, became quite frightened, end of quote. And the other account says Silas, quote, lost his nerve and became very much frightened, thinking that all was lost. And all was lost. But both accounts agree the day was saved by 25-year-old Anna. Both accounts say that she took her baby, Townsend, turned around and pitched him to Thomas in the back. Now Thomas has three kids. With her left hand, she took Silas and jerked him off that seat. Got him out of the way because he was of no help. Got a hold of those reins and began trying to do what she could with those reins, and they weren't any help. Leaped off that chair and got on the backs of those oxen. Got up to the front of their heads and turned their heads toward shore and beat them until they got to the other side. I've had her in some of my congregations. This woman's a strong woman. She has strong views. She got them over the other side. I think Thomas said, "Honey, are you all right?" It's not right. It's not in here what she said to Thomas. They got to the other side. They made it all the way to Oregon. And Thomas said, "Let's go down to Jackson County." That didn't make any sense. Nobody lived in Jackson County. There's not a lot of people live there now, but down in those days, they went to Jackson County, which is down in the southern part of the state, and she was one of three women in the whole county. And she has baby number four, and you could tell what's coming. You could tell from three pages in my book what's coming. Of course. Thomas dies. He's been dying ever since they left Independence. He takes her down to a godforsaken county where nobody lives but a bunch of miners. She has baby number four and he dies. What is she going to do? She's got four babies and a wagon. She sells the wagon for $100, buys flour, makes bread, and sells the bread for $200. I tell you, I like this woman. She's been treasurer in some of the congregations I've served. She turns that $100 wagon into $200, and then she writes Silas Higgins. He's still shaking in his boots. He can't remember how he made it there. She writes him and says, "You come get me and take me to where some people live." And she moves to Marion County, and she remarries. And I found an account that said she stayed strong in the church all of her life. She was prominent in the church, Mary Rigdon. There was a family in Indiana named Watkins. Big strapping dad, William Lynch Watkins, and the wife was Sarah Smith Watkins. And they had a teenage girl named Mary who was 16 when the trip started, and four little brothers who were, I think, all under 10. And they left Indiana. They were from Wayne County, a little village called Clarksburg. This was in 1852. Of all the years to go to Oregon, the worst year to go was 52. I mean, people died every year. But 52, they died in droves. Do you know that in all those years of going across the trail, one out of every 17 adults died on the trail. If you're traveling with 34 people, which was a pretty average train, two of the adults were going to die before you got to Oregon. One out of 17. And children, one out of five. One out of every five children that started to Oregon died and buried along the way. Here come the Watkins. They made it all the way to Independence. They crossed the Missouri. They start out. Why did so many people die that year? That was the year that cholera swept the trail. What a disease. You woke up feeling good one morning, you could be dead that night. It acted so fast. And Mr. Watkins contracted cholera. It happened so fast at the Platte River, and he died. And they had no plan B. He suddenly died, and they're digging a grave at the side of the river. And they buried him, and Sarah's crying, and the children are crying. They don't know whether to turn around and go back to Indiana. And all the people in the train who were members of the church said, "Come on to Oregon with us. You don't have anybody back in Indiana. You might as well stay with us. We'll take care of you." And they talked them into staying in the train. And so they did. On they went. But when they got to the Sweetwater River out in Wyoming, the mother contracted cholera. And Sarah called Mary to her side, who's just turning 17, and said, "Honey, I can't whip this. I'm sorry. I'm not going to be able to overcome this. You're going to have to grow up fast, honey. I've seen that you've been making eyes at Calvin Walker. And I want to tell you now that you have my permission to marry him." And Mary said, "Oh, Mother, don't talk about that. Not at a time like this." And Sarah said, "This is the right time. You have my permission to marry him." I can't imagine those words coming out of my mouth. 17 years old. "You have my..." I can't even say it. "You have my permission to marry him." 17 years old. But Sarah died at the Sweetwater River. And Mary had to dig a grave and bury her mother. She had buried her daddy and now she buries her mama. And on July 4th at Independence Rock, she marries her Calvin Walker. And the ceremony is performed by a minister in the church whose last name is Begley, B-E-G-L-E-Y, but I'm never able to trace him in Oregon. So on she goes with her new husband, and they come through the Blue Mountains, and they get down to the Dalles, and they come down the Columbia River, and they get on the Barlow Toll Road, and they come around Mount Hood, and they come all the way over to Philip Foster's place. And they get over to Philip Foster's place, and her husband suddenly dies. Scarlet fever or something like that. And she buries him. She is 17 years old, and she's buried her dad, her mom, and her husband. And she goes into the back room of Philip Foster's place, and she falls asleep, exhausted. And when she wakes up, she has been robbed of what few possessions she had in this world. And she stands there crying, with four frightened little brothers clinging to her. She is 17 years old. I can't get my arms all the way around this story. I can't imagine it. What were you doing at 17? I wasn't burying my parents. Didn't have four little children in my family looking to me for leadership. She goes on down to Oregon City. She marries George Ritchie's. His wife had just died. Good marriage, I think. 40-some years until George died. Except for this. She was profoundly Christian, and George never shared her faith. She was what they call today spiritually single. Happily married, but spiritually single. I went and found her grave a few months ago, and that wasn't easy to find, Mount Hope Cemetery. I don't think I could have ever found it on my own. I had to go to a funeral home finally and say, "Can you tell me where this cemetery is?" And they said, "Oh yeah, you're never going to find that one. Here, we'll draw you a map." And I got out there. I went to see her grave. On her side of the marker, there was a cross. There was an open Bible. And there were scriptures. And on George's side, there was nothing. I was hoping maybe at the end of his life, but there was nothing. She was spiritually single. Then I started looking around her grave, and I saw all the children she had by George. And I noticed the dates on their markers, and she had buried every one of them. She buried her dad, her mom, her first husband, and all of her children. But I found two different accounts that said that Mary Ritchie's was the strength of the church. She was the first one there opening the doors. She was the one lighting the candles. She was the one sweeping off the porch. She was the one preparing communion. She was the strength of that little church, and she'll deep still until she died at 70. That's my sister. I'm proud of her. I stood at her grave that day and knelt and prayed and thanked God that I have people like this in my heritage, that people like this who have gone before me and laid the foundation on which I now build my life and on which I proclaim Christ in the Western States. But you've never heard of her, Mary Ritchie's, whose life, at least briefly, comes to light in the pages of this book. But there were countless people like Mary Ritchie's who suffered pain and suffering coming across the trail. When the Huntingtons came across the trail, two of their little girls died, William and Eliza Huntington, one of our great preachers in Washington Territory. And they didn't know how to bury those children. They didn't have anything to bury them in. And Eliza took her wedding dress and cut the wedding dress up into two parts and buried those two children in her wedding dress. There was nothing else to bury them in. When Zedekiah Davis came across with his wife, they had both been baptized by Raccoon John Smith. They couldn't wait to get to Oregon. Sorry. He had to bury her and come on to Oregon alone and try to pick up the pieces and start life all over again. It was so typical in those days for the man to go ahead to Oregon and say to his family, like James Addison Bushnell said to his wife and his little baby boy, "I'm going to go on and pan for gold. And when I'm rich, I'm going to call for you. I'm going to send a letter back here to Missouri, and I want you to come and join me in the Promised Land." Well, he comes to Oregon, and he turns left, and he goes to California, and he pans for gold, and he does pretty good. Bushnell got quite a bit of money. So he writes a letter back to his wife. "I've got quite a bit of money now. It's time. You come. Get in the wagon and come. Bring my brothers. Bring my sisters. Bring Mom. Y'all come, and I'll be waiting for you." And they didn't come. And he panicked. Where are they? I wonder if that letter got there. How could you trust the letters in 1853? He didn't know if the letter got there or not. Come to think of it, how can you trust the letters in 1999? I wrote you last week. Did you get that letter I sent you? He wasn't sure that letter got there or not. And so he spent $400. That's a lot of money in 1853. And gets on a boat in San Francisco and goes all the way down around Mexico and over to the Panama Canal. Only there isn't no Panama Canal. He gets off that boat and walks across Panama. It's only 12 miles. And hopes there'll be a boat on the other side and buys a ticket all the way up the Atlantic coast, all the way past the Carolinas and the Virginias. Gets off at Boston, gets on a train, and through the heartland of America, all the way through New England, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, down to the Ohio River, gets on a boat, takes off down the Ohio River to the confluence with the Mississippi, up the Mississippi to Missouri, gets off that boat and gets onto a stagecoach, takes that stagecoach back into the hinterlands of Missouri. And it's getting late at night when he gets into his little town there in Adair County, and he sees Frank Atkins, his brother-in-law. Frank! Frank, it's me, James, home. Home from Oregon. Home from the gold fields. Where's my wife? Where's my little boy? Where's Mom? Where's my brothers? And Frank says, they're gone. Gone? Gone where? What do you mean, Frank, gone? Gone to Oregon to see you. How long ago did they leave, Frank? Oh, I guess it's been a little over 3 months now. He stands looking toward Oregon. They are 3 months ahead of him on that trail. He writes in his diary, "My feelings can be better imagined than described. When I heard this fact, after traveling over 15,000 miles to meet my loved ones, expecting to clasp them to my heart, only to learn that they were far away journeying toward the setting sun to meet me, was almost more than I could bear. And I was, for a while, completely stunned." Now, some words have changed in the last 150 years, but I understand that word, stunned. I think it still means what it meant there. But there was nothing I could do but turn around and return the way I had come and try to get to Oregon before they did. Gets on the stagecoach and back to the Mississippi. Gets on a boat and down the Mississippi to the confluence with the Ohio. Up that Ohio River to the railroad tracks in Ohio, through Pennsylvania, New York, New England, to Boston. Gets on a boat in Boston all the way down the Atlantic coast to Panama. There's still no canal there. Gets off that boat and walks those 12 miles saying, somebody ought to put a canal in here. Gets to the other side and hopes there'll be a boat there. Waits a long time. Finally, there's a boat. Comes all the way around Mexico, up the coast, bypasses San Francisco, and gets all the way to Portland and arrives after dark a little more than 2 months later on October 18, 1853. And he got off in Portland and estimated that he had just traveled 23,000 miles since July 1. Unbeknownst to him, his precious family was included in the wagon train that is now known to history as the Lost Wagon Train. They were tempted by people who said, "We know a shortcut. Come this way. Get off that trail. We know a way right across this desert." And they got off in that Oregon desert in eastern Oregon at the Malheur River, and they almost perished out there. Wandered around out there for weeks, and finally were rescued. Finally came out in those mountains above Springfield, Oregon. Do you know who named Springfield, Oregon? I mean, whose spring was it? It was obviously somebody's spring in somebody's field in Springfield, Oregon. Right across the Willamette River from Eugene. Right across from the University of Oregon. It was named by the Briggs family, Church Christ folk. Isaac and Betsy Briggs, their grave is right there in the cemetery at Springfield, founders of Springfield. And their oldest boy, Elias, and his wife, Mary, those two families of Briggs ran a ferry service. That's how they made their money, ran a ferry service connecting Eugene and Springfield. And they're the ones who had the spring in their field. And word got to them one day that there were people lost up in those mountains. And they went up there and saved them. A lot of them were their brothers and sisters in Christ, including the Bushnell family. They went up there and saved them. I found accounts that said they went up there and sang hymns to them. They took food to them. And they lifted their spirits and encouraged them and said, "We'll get you down. It's okay. We'll get you down." And they came down that river and came into Springfield. And meanwhile, James Addison Bushnell shows up in Portland. And he says, "I started walking. And I walked and I walked and I walked all the way down to Salem. And when I get down to Salem, I spent..." Here's his actual quote. Quote, "I paid my last dime for lodgings the night before in Salem." Here's a man who had come all the way out to Oregon and California, made all that money, and now he is flat broke. Of course, he's traveled 23,000 miles around the world. He is flat broke, and he takes off from Salem, and he's looking for his family. And he walks, and he walks, and he came down late at night, and he found lodging at the home of Mollen Harlow, a brother in the Lord. And Brother Harlow says, "Yes, yes, there is a woman with a young boy over at the Briggs place that matches the description you're giving me." And he says, "It was too late that night to press on. But I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep much that night. Neither did I stay for breakfast the next morning. After a separation of 20 months and crossing the continent three times, I rushed to Springfield and was soon in the arms of my wife and saw my little boy again." So the story ends up happening. Bushnell becomes an elder in the church at Eugene. He's buried at that cemetery I told you about yesterday, Looper, where they're all buried back in there, surrounded by the poison oak and with the gate that won't open that I had to hop over and clean off the graves. But they're all back there, buried over by Grand Prairie, outside that Grand Prairie spot. You know, this last year, a group of Christians in Oregon said to me, "We want you to come to Oregon this year, and we're going to rent a bus. It holds 40 seats. We want you to get on the microphone up at the front of this bus, and we want you to just drive around Oregon and show us cemeteries and old houses, and we're going to charge $9 a person to pay for that coach. We're going to do that three straight days." And I said, "You're out of your mind. I don't think you're going to find 40 people want to go see cemeteries. I don't usually get many go with me." But I went, and I was surprised. We had a full coach three straight days, and off we went. The first day, we took off, and of course, I lead History of Hymns tours every year. I take every May I spend in England and Scotland, and I take whatever Americans are willing to go with me. And 28 went this year, 27 last year. I never get tired of climbing into the cleft of the rock where Augustus Montague, top lady, found shelter from the storm, and singing again, "Rock of Ages, cleft for me," in the very spot where the words were written. I never get tired of walking up those three flights of stairs. Mary Wallace always lets us in. It's now a private home. To go to John and Mary Wallace's house and walk up the three flights of stairs to the old bedroom, which was like an office. The desk is still there, and the chair is still there, and scriptures are still nailed onto the wall. Fireplace is right where it always has been. And to join hands and sing Amazing Grace in the very room where John Newton wrote it over 200 years ago. Never get tired of doing that. And so I spun all those stories. And I would get up there, and then we would sing, and we would sing. Then we'd get to the next cemetery. And I took them over to Mack Waller's grave, Hilltop Cemetery. I said, "I don't think anybody's been here in 105 years. They buried this man in 1893. He came to Oregon in 1847, and he arrived on his 30th birthday, 1847. And he died in 93. What's that? 46 years. He baptized 7,000 people into Christ. Now, that's not many, but that's more than Norm and I together. And we've been working hard. 7,000 he baptized out there. And he died in 1893. They buried him at Hilltop. Big marker. Big monument. We gathered around that marker, and I spun stories about Mack Waller. And I said, "I feel like singing. Any of you feel like singing?" We joined hands around that grave, and we sang, "Up from the grave he arose with a mighty triumph for his foes." And I tell you, there wasn't a dry eye in that circle. We wept unashamedly. You can laugh at that. That's pretty silly. That's pretty maudlin. But you ought to do it sometimes, my friends. There are cemeteries all around here that bear the graves of those who've gone before us, those who kept the faith, those who passed on to us an immeasurable heritage, who are now a part of the great cloud of witnesses that I'm going to talk about at 4 o'clock. The great cloud of witnesses that surround us now. The great cloud that say to us, keep running, keep your eyes on Jesus, and run with patience the race that is set before you. Run, run, run. We went on down to Yamhill County, into Carlton. We turned left at Carlton, drove west about 4 miles. There's the sign, right across the road, McBride Family Cemetery Road. That's a mouthful. Now, you were here yesterday, the McBride family. The old patriarch was Thomas Crawford McBride, first man to ever preach for the Restoration Movement in the state of Missouri. First preacher we ever had in Missouri. Came in 1816. Born in 1777, Thomas Crawford McBride. He was from that Mulkey movement over in Nashville. He preached in Nashville. He knew John Mulkey. He came over to Missouri in 1816. It was his boy, Dr. James McBride, who Abraham Lincoln made the leader over at Honolulu, made him the ambassador. Thomas Crawford McBride was so sorry when his children all went to Oregon in 1846, and then his wife died that winter. And when the rest of his children got ready to go in 47, he said, well, I'll go with you. I don't have anybody back here in Missouri. He was 70 years old and almost blind, but he made it 2,000 miles. And John Rogers McBride was keeping his diary, and he said, boy, we're out of time. I'll close with this. He was keeping his diary, and he said, I looked up, and there was my grandfather. We didn't even know he was coming. Snowy white hair, 70 years old. He wasn't going home, I'll tell you that. He'd come 2,000 miles. And you know, he preached 10 more years. He died in 1857 at 80. And they built a grave for him. And I went back there last summer and we gathered around that grave and it was all beat up. You couldn't read the Thomas. And I said to this group, let's build this man a better marker. And we raised $800. And they put that marker in about 2 months ago. And I ran a picture of it in my magazine last issue, the Pacific Church News. Next time you're at McBride Family Cemetery in Yamhill County, go see that nice marker that we just put into Thomas Crawford McBride. I suppose you could say that was a waste of money. We didn't think so. We had a great day that day as we knelt around his grave and thanked God for what that man meant in our life. This afternoon at 4 o'clock, we're in the cafe. They keep moving us around to see if you can find me. We started over there yesterday. I'm right now. It's 10:45, isn't it? Okay, at 4 o'clock, we're in the cafe, and I'm going to tell you about my hero from this book, Abbot Levi James Todd and the Great Cloud of Witnesses. I'm on...